This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we're going to talk to New York Times bestselling author John Sanford. Yes, the John Sanford. His new book is called Escape Clause. It's a Virgil Flowers novel, and it's out from Putnam on October 18th. Hello!
How are you?
Good to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
You're one busy guy. You just keep writing and writing and writing.
Yeah, I just, it's pretty much of a job for me, so I'm like 40 hours a week.
Oh, yeah. Is that tough for you?
It is. It really is, but I like it. I mean, I like what I'm doing, so it's okay.
It's okay with you. I mean, I've heard Nora Roberts say she works like 70 hours a week, and I'm thinking, boy, that's a lot of hours to put in on writing.
I'll tell you what, I sort of believe it, too. I sort of believe that she works 70 hours a week.
But, I mean, it's hard to imagine writing. I mean, after a while, I would think you're I start to blur when you're writing that much.
Yeah, I think my brain would blow up if I was trying to write 70 hours.
Now, I have to ask you about this title, Escape Clause. Is it some kind of play on words because of the tigers that are involved in the story?
It could be. You know, like I didn't actually invent the title. That was invented by my editor, Neil Niren. And I kept thinking, I wonder if they should make that C-L-A-W-S instead of C-L-A-U-S-E. And I thought, no, that's a little bit too cute. But it works either way, so.
Your books have a lot of underlying humor in them. And is that intentional? Well, and has that been that way since the beginning?
Well, you know, the thing is that police work has a lot of funny stuff that goes on all the time. Sometimes it's kind of cruel humor, and sometimes it's just funny, and sometimes, you know, it's just odd. It's because of the crazy stuff that happens to cops. The Davenport books have had a line of kind of wry humor that goes through them, which is just cop talk. The Virgil Flowers books are more explicitly funny, and it's been that way since the start. I wanted Virgil to be a lighter character than Davenport, because Davenport, the Prey books, are very dark, a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
There are a couple of dark Virgil books, just because I don't want people to... I don't want people to think that they know exactly what's going to happen, because then one, why would you buy the book? So I want to, every once in a while, I want to slap the fans upside the head with a book that's something that they completely don't expect. But Virgil is deliberately lighter and funnier.
I'm laughing just thinking about some of the scenes in the book, especially the scene with the refrigerator. I can't go into detail because I'll give something away. Knowing me, I'll say too much, but I mean, the scene with the, he's trying to...
Well, did you think that was funny or ugly?
No, it's funny. Well, and it's even funnier thinking back on it. but it's a very grim scene, too, so it's kind of like, you know, it's, you don't know how to feel other than to laugh. And maybe laughing helps you deal with the horror of it. That's what I'm thinking. I don't know.
Whatever you think.
Yeah. This is just what's running through my head. I don't know. I may be a little nuts. But, you know.
No, I deliberately did that. I mean, you know, the whole concept of that seems so stupid to me that it's at the same time awful and at the same time possible. You know, it's all of those things and the discovery of the refrigerator was also, was deliberately funny. So.
Oh yeah, and then the scene with the fisherman—that was great. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm supposed to take your book seriously, but it's certainly hard at times not to laugh. And I think you have to laugh. I mean, the best things that you watch on TV and read are things that you laugh and you find serious at the same time. Don't you think?
I think so. And know, the thing is that the main bad guy in this book is so goofy, you know, he doesn't almost seem to know what he's doing. He does know what he's doing, but he doesn't take any responsibility for it, and it all seems very kind of reasonable to him, as awful as it is, and you know, and he takes a lot of Xanax and to try to calm himself down, and he's just such a goofy character that I had a good time writing him. I did have a good time writing that guy.
So who are you more like? Are you more like Virgil Flowers or Lucas Davenport?
I'm more like a journalist who actually watches. because, you know, the thing is that Lucas is, Lucas is good looking and he's rich and he's tall and he's violent and, you know, he's a kind of a chick magnet and he's got all these things going at the same time and he's not really like a cop. He's like a cross between a cop and a movie star. Virgil is kind of this really laid-back guy, and I don't know, I've written 45 books. I don't know if a really laid-back guy could write 45 books, and so I tend to be a little tense a lot of the time, and Virgil's not. You know, Virgil likes to listen to a little country music and play a little basketball.
Well, what's the difference in ages between Virgil and Lucas?
Lucas is in his early 50s now, and Virgil is like 35.
Oh, so he's considerably younger.
Yeah.
He can run around more and brutalize his body more.
Lucas was Virgil's boss, and every once in a while he'll look at what Virgil's doing, especially when Virgil's chasing women, and this jealousy comes through because Lucas used to chase women all the time, and he's perfectly happy being married and having children and all that kind of stuff. But there's still this, he watches Virgil doing this kind of stuff, and it's like, boy, you know, this is so irresponsible, but you know that he's a little jealous, too, so.
Exactly. I must admit, this is, what, the ninth Virgil Flowers book? This is the first one of the Virgil Flowers series that I've read. For some reason, I'm a Lucas Davenport fan, but I never really got around to reading the Virgil Flowers, and now I like Virgil Flowers, too, so now I like them both. Sounds going to be... Now I'm going to have to read two books a year.
Yeah, well... I hope so. I mean, I'm out here killing myself writing two books a year. Like, oh, you know... Make me happy if you'd read both of them. It's like I need the money.
But you have such a skill for telling a good story. Every book I've ever read by you has had a great story to it, and a fascinating story. And you're so good at doing that. And yet I found there's a lot of writers out there who aren't good at doing that, or some. I should say some. I don't know if I'd say a lot, but I've read books where the story just wasn't interesting, or the story was slow. But your books are never slow. They're always fast paced. There's always something going on. And I love the
way... Well, you know, the books are not inspirations. The books are engineering projects for me. And so I'm also a thriller fan, and I've been a thriller fan all my life. I mean, I studied American literature when I was in college. I majored in American literature and history. So American studies is what it was called at the time. But even then, when I was reading, Melville... I was also reading John D. MacDonald. And so I've always been a thriller fan. I know what should go into books, so I try when I'm engineering one of my books to keep them moving. I try to make the characters interesting.
Well, you really do it so well. I don't know what it is about your writing that is always so fascinating. I've never picked up a book by you and been bored. Never.
Well, I sit around and think about it, for months at a time about how I try to make them interesting, and I think that's how most thriller writers operate.
But then you have the problem of every book having to be different too. So it's hard. I mean, that's really really difficult. You can't use the same pattern twice. I mean, you can't use the same situations more than once.
Yeah, well, you got to be careful about that because sometimes, you know, when you're writing as many books as I do, if you're writing twice a year, one book tends to bleed over into the other in a bad way, not in a good way. You know, like you find yourself using the same language for two books in a row that are quite different. different than what the story is. And so you've really got to work to keep those things separate and keep that from happening, because
would you
it
have,
won't happen.
Yeah, did you ready to pick up on those things if they do happen?
They do. And then you do things when you're writing fast like this that the readers will say, you know, you wrote this one scene and I couldn't tell who was talking. And you think, this is not good. You always have to know who's talking in a book.
I have trouble with that too.
And I once had a woman point out kind of a lengthy scene in which people were kind of going back and forth. There's like a ping pong thing where they were talking, and by the time you got to the end of it, it was pretty unclear about exactly who was talking. And I don't think I've made that mistake again, because you know, when somebody tells you something like that, little alarm bells go off in the back of your head, and you say, you know, you can't do that.
Right, and that is, I found that myself having problems with that too, figuring out, and I'll go back and try to read it, and when it goes back and forth, and see if I can figure out who's talking, and it's not always easy, it's difficult. But go ahead.
One of the things about that is that I think that when somebody is reading a book that they're interested in, it's almost like they're dreaming, and they are seeing this. They are seeing this story going on, and they're seeing the characters kind of in the back of their mind. It's almost like a special kind of a dream. And the problem is that when you do something like have an obviously mistaken fact, just have something that's wrong, or if you do something where they can't tell who's talking, what you do is you break a hole in the dream. You break into it, and all of a sudden the reader is kicked out of the dream.
Mm.
And if you keep interrupting the story like that, they're going to stop reading the book.
Yeah, the readers are very perceptive. You have to be on your they keep you on your toes. I mean, you have to, if you do something wrong, they're going to let you know about it a lot of times, one way or another, email or letter or whatever it takes anymore.
Or they stop buying the books.
That's
what you really want to avoid.
I can't imagine stop reading you. That would be torture for me not to read your books. You know, and I don't notice mistakes in your books. In fact, I don't ever remember seeing a mistake in your books. But then again,
I've made a number of them, and I hear about them.
Really? Huh.
I had a situation two or three books ago, four or five books ago, maybe now, in which I. A guy walked into a room and he killed a character, a woman named Marcy. She was a cop, and he shot her in the chest and killed her. And it's a very unexpected development because she'd been in a lot of books of mine.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
As he walked in the room, he clicked the safety off on his gun. Well, the gun was a Glock, and Glocks don't have safeties. And I heard about this from a lot of people. What actually happened was that I was trying to be more realistic, and so I had a cop. The gun originally was a Beretta, and then I was told and it was taken away from a Minneapolis cop. And I was told by a Minneapolis cop that I was talking to about later, and he said, "We don't carry Berettas anymore. We can't do that. We've got to carry the issue gun, which are Glocks." And I said, "Oh, poop." And so what I did is that I mentioned this Beretta because it was a key thing in the book. I must have mentioned it 30 times, so I went back to my word processor, and I just mass-changed all references from Beretta to Glock.
Mm.
And I'd forgotten about the guy clicking the safety off. And so now I've got him clicking the... When it was clicking the safety off the Beretta, it was fine. When I changed it to Glock, then it's not fine. And it's a mistake, and a lot of people called me on it. And they called me on it publicly. They you know, I'll be sitting in I was sitting in a... thing in Minneapolis at a book event, and a woman asked me, "How much do you know about guns?" And I said, "Well, I know quite a bit about guns, and I know what you're asking about. You're asking about the safety on the Glock." And she said, "Yes, I am. My brother told me there isn't one." And she said, "Well, your brother's mostly right. There is kind of a safety on the Glock, but not really." So,
that's what you meant.
And that kind of stuff will throw people out of stories, especially people who know about guns.
I could care less about that. I mean, you try to get it right, but it, you know, you're not perfect, and nobody would ever think of you as perfect. But the stories, to me, are what keep me coming back, and they always will, because you tell great stories. And you write so well. I mean, the way you write. I mean, and I always think to myself, you know, writing 2-3 books a year. I said it can get stale. I mean, stories can get stale if you write too many books. But yours never do.
Well, you know, that's a struggle too. And I don't know. You know, I don't know how that struggle is going to come out in the end. Tell you the truth.
Now, the two tigers. Is this based? The missing tigers that propelled the story. Is that real? Is that something that really happened, or where did that come from, or did that just come out of your head somewhere?
That actually came from a National Geographic article, I think, about the use of rare animals in traditional Chinese medicine.
Mm.
I mean, you know, they've killed off virtually all the rhinos just to get the horn.
Oh, yeah.
On their nose, and you know, they kill these huge animals. They take only the horn and leave the rest of the animal to rot. And they've done it for a number of things, including tigers. And these Amur tigers are extremely rare. There may be only 50 of them left in the wild now, and they're mostly in zoos. And the thing is that the thing about this kind of traditional medicine is that the rarer things are, the more expensive it becomes. And so the more of them that are killed and the closer they come to extinction, the more valuable they become and the more likely they are to be killed. So that's what started it. And then I happened to know that the Minnesota Zoo did have a couple of Amur tigers. And so what I did is that I went to the zoo and I realized you probably, you know, it's a stretch, but you could do what my characters did. I mean, all the scene setting there is correct. I mean, you know, what the fence is, how the hill is inside the cage, how you'd get them out of the zoo to begin with, and so all of that stuff is.
So you actually went there and looked at everything and made sure that you had it in the story.
So and so you know, theoretically they could have done that, but I mean, you know, it really is a stretch, but they could have done that, and it you know, gave me a good kick to the story. What I do is that as I'm wandering around writing, say, a Davenport book, in the back of my mind I'll already be thinking about the next Virgil book, and I have this little icon right in the middle of my computer screen that says New Virgil Book, and that's actually an icon for a Word document that I can just click on, and then the document comes up, and I can type a quick note, and I can just close it, and
about that?
It just sits there in the middle of the screen. So then I've always got, you know, by the time I get to writing the Virgil book, I've got that stuff sitting there waiting for me, you know, the thoughts that have taken place over the last 6 months.
Yeah. Now, your next Lucas Davenport, from what I understand, is going to be called Golden Prey.
Yes.
And is that finished already?
No, it's not. I'm about 50,000 words into it. It will be finished in probably about middle of December, it looks like now.
Very cool. That's a series that just goes on and on and on. I never get tired of that series. I must admit, I got tired of Spencer, and I'm glad Robert Parker can't hear me say that. But I got tired of Spencer, but I never get tired of Lucas. Never.
Spencer, I read Spencer from the book one. When I read book one of the Spencer thing, I thought this is going to guy is going to be a bestseller forever, and he was.
Yeah, he was, and a lot of people love it, and they're still publishing under somebody else, but I mean, Spencer's still around. It's not the Robert Parker Spencer totally, but it's close enough.
When books go on like that for a really long time, you start to run into these kind of weird effects, because Spencer is still Spencer's still beating people up, you know, boxing with people, but if you read the early ones like I did, Spencer was a Korean War veteran. And so a Korean War veteran, say he was 20 in 1950, that would make him 70, that'd make him about 90 now, and he's out beating people up in the streets of Boston. So that you get start getting to some weird effects when you get into these long series like we have.
Right. Now, would you ever stop the Prey series?
Not unless I stop writing.
But what would do you have, but I'm wondering, do you have plans if something, God forbid, should ever happen to you? Do you have plans for somebody to continue it?
Oh, no. No, I don't have any plans like that at all.
Now, but does the publisher have the right to do that without your permission?
No, but the estate would, I suppose. And, you know, I wouldn't encourage encourage that, and I don't think that anybody in my family expects to do that. But
right.
But I think the estate would probably have that right.
I can't imagine anybody writing like you, though. I mean, you have a very distinctive style, and I can't imagine anybody copying that.
There are other guys around that'd be more difficult. You try to think of what how somebody would try to write Carl Hyacinth's books.
Or Stephen King, even worse.
Yeah, and it would be pretty tough.
So. When you read an author, you know their style. You want that style, and you don't want it. You don't want anything else. I mean, I don't.
I still read the Spencer books, and there are at least two writers for them, and they're very, very good writers. But they're not exactly like Parker, and so you feel the differences. They're good writers and they're good stories, but you can feel the differences between.
Right. So it's a little disappointing then.
I don't know if they're disappointing. They're just not.
Well, I mean, disappointing in the way that they're not. It's not Robert Parker writing them. You're not getting Robert Parker's humor, Robert Parker's way of telling a story. In that way, they're disappointing. Is what I was getting at, I guess.
Well, I think that also substitute writers also feel like they have to put in every single little aspect of the whole Parker thing. You know, they've got to have Hawk in there, and they've got to have his girlfriend in there, and they've got to have the girlfriend's dog, Pearl the Wonder Dog, or whatever she's called.
Yeah,
they got to have all that stuff in there, and Parker didn't feel like that. Parker sometimes would leave those people out because it was still a Robert Parker book, I think that a lot of the guys who are now writing the books feel like they have to have all those little things in there to make the fans happy, and it feels kind of awkward sometimes. So,
well, if you're writing Lucas and you suddenly realize that you're out of stories, will you stop the series, or do you never run out of ideas?
I'm not going to run out of stories. I mean, all you have to do is look in the newspaper.
And yeah, that's right.
I mean, the stuff that happens in the newspaper is crazier than anything that happens in any of the thriller novels.
I like the latest one where the guy had to pay $40 to hold his son in the hospital. I love that one.
I don't know that one, but
can you imagine charging somebody $40 to hold their own son?
I did see that story. Yeah, I did.
It's funny. I mean, it's just so. I mean, who comes? Where are these stories? I mean, somebody sits by somewhere and finds all these stories. I don't know who it is, but they find these the most ridiculous. Not ridiculous. They're just kind of like interesting stories, and then they put them online.
If you go online and read the Daily Mail every day, you're amazed at what the United States looks like.
Exactly. It's just so you're not done Golden Prey yet. You'll be done by December. Will that be out in April or May, do you think?
In May, probably. Early May.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly my birthday, so that'll fit real nice.
All right.
Are you tired of writing altogether? Are there days you wake up and you want to retire?
No, not particularly. I mean, you know, it's just I've done this since I was in fifth grade, you know, and it's just my life. That's all.
Now you also occasionally write science fiction books and other kinds of books and books with is that your daughter or your wife that you're writing with?
The trilogy that I wrote of young adult novels is with my wife.
That's your wife. Okay. Yes.
And the science fiction book I wrote with a friend of mine whose name is Katine, and I don't think I'll write any more science fiction, but that idea sort of captured me, and I had a guy who was had a joint degree in English and physics from Caltech, Katine, so that he could do the parts of the book that I just couldn't do.
Right.
And we were trying to write a science fiction book that did not violate any laws of physics.
Exactly.
And, we didn't have any interstellar travel or travel through wormholes or any of that stuff.
So for now, you're just going to write Virgil Flowers and Lucas Davenport, basically.
Yeah, I'll probably jump out of the series every once in a while with a you know odd book, but basically Flowers and Davenport.
And they're great characters. I mean, they're just such great characters. I want to be finishing this book tonight. I get excited thinking about going back reading it again, and as I do all your books. You're just an amazing storyteller.
Okay. Well, I hope you enjoy it.
And that means a lot to us. We got to let you run because you got other things here, but we've been talking to John Sanford. His new book's called Escape Clause. It's out October 18th from Putnam, and this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks, John.
Yep, thank you.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.